As you scour the cookbooks for Thanksgiving recipes, you'll find the traditional turkey, stuffing, pumpkin pie. But Weekend Edition food commentator Bonnie Wolfe wanted to know what colonial-era Native Americans ate at harvest time. She foraged in the woods for answers and sent this audio postcard.
It's a brisk, clear morning at Adkins Arboretum, a peaceful 400-acre preserve on Maryland's eastern shore. I meet Bill Schindler, an anthropology professor at nearby Washington College, and Bill Trackett, a mycologist, that's a mushroom guy, to wander along streams and through meadows looking for something to eat. Right away, Bill Schindler finds some tasty-looking weeds.
One of the earliest wild plants that we think Native Americans began domesticating around here is Chenopodium berlandieri, which is a lamb's quarters.
They grow all over.
The greens are fabulous, but the seeds are also very healthy and full of all kinds of wonderful proteins and oils.
Next, we check out the marsh.
There are some great plants that grow in the marsh. They're one of the first plants to come out in the early spring when, you know, people, especially in the past, have overwintered and haven't had much to eat. In some of the accounts, you know, John Smith is talking about these things being pulled out of the water. You know, Native Americans saying about as big as a man's thigh. And they have tons of accounts of Native Americans eating these things.
We haven't seen many mushrooms when Bill Trackett finds a little rusty red one.
Ooh.
Oh, what do we have?
Ooh, look at those little
Oh, yeah, look at them. Oh, look at it. That's it, quaternarius. It's a brown quaternarius. I mean, it's edible, but not edible. In other words, it doesn't...
Not palatable.
Edible, but not tasty?
Yeah.
Both Bills caution about eating anything you're not sure about. Some mushrooms are poisonous, and other wild plants need toxins processed out. But not the wild grapes that Bill Schindler spots.
Mmm. The juicier ones are still pretty good. You can always tell the grape are the only ones that have these curly-Q-looking things coming off the vines.
We walk through a patch of what look like more little green weeds.
This is sheep sorrel. It's supposed to somehow look like a sheep's head.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Hey, that's cool.
Does it taste like regular sorrel?
It does. It does slightly. Let me get a few more. It's a little lemony.
Yeah.
They're great in salads. They will get a... seed head on them. That those are fabulous too.
Naturally, Bill Schindler has a trowel in his pocket, so he digs up an evening primrose root, cleans it off, and passes it around.
Just
tastes like a radish.
If you come at this kind of wild plants thing from, you know, our modern perspective on food, you're not going to enjoy a whole lot of it, and you're not going to have a huge variety of things that you're going to want to try. I mean, you know, a lot of the plants that we eat have been domesticated down to the point where they've lost a lot of their flavor.
But keep an open mind. The woods are an open-air food court. A lot of what you see or step on is edible. So, as an alternative to the green bean casserole, why not try lamb's quarters cooked with a little hickory nut butter and wild onion this holiday?
Bonnie Wolfe is working on a book about the foods of Maryland's Eastern Shore. To see recipes made with wild plants, go to our website, npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. For months, retailers have been trying to get Americans into a holiday shopping mood. Christmas merchandise started to appear in stores around the time shoppers were looking for back-to-school shoes. But this week, the holiday retail season begins to heat up. And here to discuss the outlook for retail sales is NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn Giewax. And Marilyn, I mean, the first question, are most Americans really ready to shop now?
So far, sales data suggests yes, a lot of people really are ready to start buying again. Retail sales have been up in 4 out of the last 5 months, and stores saw a particularly healthy bounce up in their revenues in October. So now the predictions for November and December are pretty positive. The National Retail Federation expects sales to be up about 2.3% for this holiday season, and other forecasters are saying even more, maybe 3%. Now, that doesn't sound great, but, you know, when you look at last year when sales were only up 0.5%, this is a good improvement. And, of course, we're way ahead of where we were in 2008 when the economy was in a free fall. That year, sales actually declined about 4%. So, yes, at the mall, the mood is pretty cheery this year, especially compared with the last couple.
What about all the people without jobs, though? Are they sitting out the shopping season?
Well, I think retailers are painfully aware that about 15 million people who want jobs still can't find them. So store managers know they're not going to see this return to the free spending ways we had in the late 1990s. But sales are rising from pretty depressed levels because people who do have jobs are feeling a lot more confident. Workers aren't seeing those scary headlines these days about massive layoffs. And, you know, employers have begun hiring again. It's slow for sure, but they are hiring. So that leaves workers feeling a little less nervous and a little more inclined to spend money.
Last year, I remember we talked about the bargains that could be had. Will shoppers find the same kinds of bargains this year?
No, the price cutting has been toned down a little bit this Thanksgiving. The surveys now are showing that while stores are certainly going to have those big splashy doorbuster promotions, prices across the board aren't really being cut as dramatically as they were the last 2 years. So you might get lured in to buy, say, a 32-inch flat-screen HDTV, whatever, for less than $200. But when you get there, you might find that most things are still at the regular price. Instead of price slashing, it seems like the retailers are trying to find other tricks to entice us in.
Like what?
Well, the big thing this year is longer hours. For the first time in its 124-year history, Sears is going to be open on Thanksgiving Day from 7 a.m. to noon. And then on Black Friday, as they call it, the next day, lots of stores are going to be opening way earlier than dawn. Macy's, for one, is going to be open at 4 a.m. instead of 5 as they usually open. And Kohl's is trying to do them one better. They're going to open at 3 a.m. And then, of course, this is kind of funny. Some of them will be starting so early that it'll actually be late. We've got Walmart's will start its Black Friday promotions at midnight, and Toys R Us, they're going to start at 10 p.m. on Thursday.
Huh. Are there other retailer tricks we should know about?
Well, the big thing is to try to push us to shop actually 24 hours a day online. So free shipping is the big thing this year. Walmart got a lot of attention earlier this month when it announced that it would have free shipping with no minimum purchase on about 60,000 items. And then the others responded, you know, you have Target, Best Buy, others have come up with their promotions, too, that have various forms of free shipping on different merchandise.
What do people want this year?
Well, if you're a kid, it's pretty traditional. The big things are Legos, Hot Wheels, dolls. Barbies are still incredibly popular. Iron Man is big this year. But for people who are a little bit older, the wish list seems to be topped by electronic gadgets, the video games, smartphones, tablet computers, e-readers. We want a buzz this year.
NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn G. Wax. Marilyn, thanks a lot.
Oh, you're welcome, Leanne.
You've heard E. Ethelbert Miller on this program before as a poet and commentator. Today, you'll hear from him as a father. He recently sat down with his daughter for the National Day of Listening Project. It's an effort to encourage people over Thanksgiving to sit down with a loved one and listen. Jasmine Simone Miller wanted to ask Ethelbert about the day he found out he was going to be a father.
My job consists of the phone ringing a lot. And I remember the phone rang, and this is before cell phones, so there's no caller ID, and the face shows up. And she said, "Well, guess what, Daddy?" You know, and I immediately went into shock. You know, it's like all of a sudden it hits you. Like, I'm a father, you know, and the night you were born. Back then, we lived in the duplex, two levels. So your mother's upstairs in the bedroom, just getting her down the steps, you know, to the next level was a job, okay? All those little exercises that they taught you,
right,
the things, you know, it's like somebody drops you off in Iraq or Afghanistan with a gun, you know, you don't know what to do, you know? And what happened? There's nobody in the hospital. And the woman said, "We don't know if we can, you know, she's not dilated, so will we admit her?" What are you talking about? I just got her here. There's no way we are going back home, you know. And so I always remember the joke was they tell me to go get ready because I wanted to be there, you know, in the room when you're born. And so they say, "Oh, go in the room and put this on." So I'm in there, like, you know, taking all my underwear and stuff off.
This is the gown.
Yeah, but I'm taking my underwear and everything off. Like, you know, no germs to go in there. And it was stupid, but you know what happened? You're being a father for the first time. So I'm in there undressing, you know. My child's not going to come out and sick, you know. So I do remember that.
And for my name, Jasmine Simone, did you and Mom already have that picked out before I was born, did you have a list of girl names and boy names in case I was one of each? And if, what, do you remember what the boy option was?
No, there was no boy options. What happened? You were easy, you know. I've always was a Nina Simone fan, and also my brother was a Nina, who you really never met. Nobody's going to mess with you. Your name is Nina Simone. I mean, Nina Simone has a serious attitude, you know. And so what happened, that name, you know, is one I felt was very empowering. The jasmine, I think, is very important in terms of, you know, just the fragrance of the flower. And I still feel that the challenge I've always faced as a writer was naming my children. And I feel that your name is like a one-line poem, and that it should resonate even before somebody even meets you.
E. Ethelbert Miller with his daughter, Jasmine Simone Miller, for the StoryCorps National Day of Listening Project. You can find tips about how to interview a loved one at nationaldayoflistening.org. This is NPR News.
And as Brian reported, high unemployment and slow growth is hitting rural parts of the country particularly hard. On this program, for the past few months, we've been inviting top economists to offer up ideas for how to help dig us out. The incoming Republican leadership in the House has argued that the road to full recovery and job growth runs through austerity, cutting the short-term deficit. Now, as we heard earlier in the program, tackling the deficit in any meaningful way may only be possible by confronting the two largest entitlement programs, Medicare and Social Security. And other economists said that you can't cut the deficit a whole lot without also cutting defense spending. Now, in past weeks, we've heard from deficit hawks and economists who want more stimulus. Today, it's Christina Romer's turn. She was the chair of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors. She stepped down from the post earlier this year and is now back at UC Berkeley, where she teaches economics.
Before I ever went to Washington and before we were in the middle of an economic crisis, I was probably as big a deficit hawk as anyone. And certainly, I am very worried about the long-term deficit. And one of the things I think that frustrates me the most about members of Congress that want to cut spending by $100 billion next year, it's like, that is bad for the economy now, and that's trivial. That doesn't solve the long-run problem. That's just a symbolic gesture, and it's in fact distracting us from what we really need to do, which is figure out how do we have deficits that aren't 15% of GDP in 2035, which is the trajectory that we're on.
Republicans really want to focus on short-term deficit reduction. They say they do. Should the president veto bills that would drastically cut the short-term deficit?
It would be bad economic policy to try to cut the deficit tremendously in the short run. This is an economy where the unemployment rate is still 9.6%. An immediate deficit reduction would be very, very hard for the economy to grow through. Now, I absolutely, like almost any mainstream economist, think the long-run deficit is a terrible problem. I'd be wildly in favor of passing a plan right now for dealing with that long-run deficit. But a good plan would almost surely have some fiscal expansion in the short run and then do the fiscal contraction when the economy is healthier.
So let's put this in simple terms. I mean, you were vocal about your support for additional stimulus. You're saying there has to be some further stimulus.
Yes. I think you can't look at where the economy is today and say that we're where we want to be. It is, you know, we are still in an economic crisis. And, you know, even if all you care about is the budget deficit, taking actions now to get the unemployment rate down is good policy. Because the thing I worry about is the longer this unemployment rate stays high, the bigger chance there is that some of it becomes permanent. And that's obviously a disaster for people, but it's a disaster for the long-run budget deficit.
You have studied the year 1937. You've written about it, and you've warned against a repeat of what happened then when President Roosevelt's recovery program basically went back into recession. That was a year when he raised taxes, when the Fed tightened monetary policy. Wouldn't President Obama risk making some of those same mistakes by insisting on any tax increases at all at this point?
It's incredibly important to draw a distinction between not raising anybody's taxes and not raising net taxes. Not every tax cut is equally effective. And the economic research is incredibly clear that tax cuts for very high income earners have about the least fiscal stimulus of any tax cut possible. So if you say, I want to cut taxes by $50 billion, I'd say don't do it for the very high income earners, but do it in the form of a payroll tax holiday or continue the making work pay tax cut that we had in the Recovery Act for another year and give that money to middle class families. They're the ones that are likely to spend it. This idea that somehow you can't raise any tax anywhere because we're in a recession, that's just bad policy.
Christina Romer, you support more stimulus and a tax increase on the wealthiest Americans. Other economists would say, you know, let's focus on deficits and not raise taxes and not spend more. What makes your case more compelling? I mean, why do you think what you believe in and what other economists who agree with you believe in will necessarily work? I mean, you don't, let's face it, I mean, you don't necessarily have facts on your side. The other side doesn't have facts on its side. We don't know the results of it, right? We just think we know what might happen.
Well, I'm going to disagree that we don't have facts on our side, because I think exactly what makes me very confident in the policies that I'm suggesting is the empirical evidence. So, for example, I'll cite a very important new study that came out of the International Monetary Fund that looked at fiscal consolidations, times when countries tried to get their budget deficit down, in 15 countries over the last 25 years. And the conclusion of that is it hurts growth. So this idea that getting your deficit down will somehow magically be good for growth, it will be painless. I think the empirical evidence is very strong that in the short run, that is something that will be painful. And I think that fact is what lies behind saying, of course, you legislate the deficit reduction. It's good policy, even from a credibility, a confidence kind of perspective, to get that plan in place. But don't be under the illusion that if you were able to cut the deficit a lot in 2011, that would somehow be good for the unemployment rate, because it absolutely would not. And I think the evidence is very strong for that position.
That's Christina Romer. She's the former chair of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors. She's now back at UC Berkeley, where she teaches economics. Christina Romer, thank you so much.
Thank you.
A professional sports league will stage its annual championship game tonight. It will be broadcast live to a nationwide audience on a major cable network. A sellout crowd is expected in Toronto. No idea what we're talking about? Don't worry. Not many people beyond the 21,000 ticket holders, and a relatively few rabid fans do. Tonight, the Colorado Rapids take on FC Dallas. That's FC as in football club, for the championship of Major League Soccer, the MLS Cup. A few months ago, during the World Cup of Soccer, we contacted David Henry Sterry, co-author of The Glorious World Cup, A Fanatic's Guide. He's on the phone from Phoenix, Arizona. Welcome back.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much.
Okay, so the World Cup, glorious. The MLS Cup, not so much. Does that sum it up?
Well, yes, in a certain sense, it kind of does. Right now in Major League Soccer and ESPN offices, executives are gnashing their teeth and pulling out their hair and moaning about how cruel the soccer gods are, because David Beckham and Landon Donovan and Thierry Henry will not be playing in the final in Toronto. And that was going to make it sexy. It was going to be sexy again, but no, it's not so much.
But what about the game? I mean, it will at least be a good game.
I'm really looking forward to it. First of all, I used to live in Dallas, so for me, the idea that FC Dallas is going to be hotter than the Cowboys, to me, it's just like I'm in a little piece of ecstasy for me.
Yeah.
I do think it's going to be a great game. Recently in the World Series, Major League Baseball was hoping that the Yankees and the Phillies, but we've seen those guys already. Same with this game. We know who Landon Donovan is. We know who David Beckham is. I think it's going to introduce a whole new cast of characters. There's a guy named David Ferreira who is like 4'9". He's like a Colombian hobbit. He's a tiny little fellow, but he's a phenomenal soccer player. He's the most valuable player of the league, and he scored an amazing goal against the Galaxy, against LA. This is going to hopefully put him on the map.
Who does Ferreira play for?
He's Dallas.
So you got Dallas in the blood. Nothing on the Rapids?
Oh, no. They're the little train that could. They have some great players. They were sort of lucky to reach the final. They have a player named Kazuke Kimura, who scored basically a seeing-eye goal that got him through. And they have Pablo Mastroianni, who's a U.S. national team player that we all know. They are definitely the underdog, but I see Dallas taking the game. I do.
Getting out the word about soccer, David Henry. Sterry is a co-author with Alan Black of The Glorious World Cup, A Fanatic's Guide. The MLS Cup kicks off tonight at 8:30 Eastern Time on ESPN. David, thanks.
It has been a pleasure, as always.
This is NPR News.